boxes of documents, top secret materials, a binder of photos.
We are learning what the FBI confiscated from Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago property. But what exactly were they looking for?
I'm Aisha Roscoe.
I'm Daniel Estrin, and this is Up First from NPR News.
A federal judge has unsealed documents related to the FBI search of Trump's home, giving us a glimpse into the focus of the investigation.
And on Capitol Hill,
Today is really a glorious day for us. We send to the president's desk a monumental bill that will be truly for the people, the Inflation Reduction Act.
Democrats say the new bill will have profound impacts on climate and health care.
Plus, life in Afghanistan, 1 year into Taliban rule. So stay with us. We've got the news you need to start your weekend. The FBI recovered highly classified information in its search of former President Trump's Mar-a-Lago property this week.
And yesterday, the federal judge who authorized the search released the warrant and an inventory of what federal agents collected.
That was at the request of Attorney General Merrick Garland and with no objection from Trump.
NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson joins us now with the latest. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Daniel.
What do we know at this point about what exactly the FBI is investigating?
Well, the paperwork tells us a lot, but not everything. The FBI took several boxes of information from former President Trump's residence and office at Mar-a-Lago, including material classified as top secret. Federal agents took a clemency grant for Trump's longtime friend, Roger Stone. They took unspecified information about the president of France, and they took at least one binder filled with photos.
Okay. Now, Trump has not been charged with any crime here, right? But I understand these warrants usually list laws that may have been violated.
That's right. No charges for President Trump or any of his former aides, but the court papers list three laws that appear to be central to the investigation. One involves obstruction of federal probes, raising the question of what investigation Trump might have been trying to obstruct. Was it this one into the documents or something else? A second law is listed that makes it a crime to conceal, remove, or mutilate government records. And finally, a part of the Espionage Act that involves gathering, transmitting, or losing sensitive information related to the national defense. Breaking any of these laws is a serious matter and could involve prison time. But again, there are currently no charges against former President Trump or any of his aides who may have packed or shipped this material to Florida.
What has Trump's public reaction been to all this?
You know, Trump and his allies first suggested the FBI had planted evidence providing no basis for that allegation. And in fact, we now know his lawyer signed off on the property receipt following the search on Monday night in Florida. Then Trump said former President Obama took classified materials when he left the White House. And in fact, the National Archives put out a statement refuting that claim. The archive says it has millions of documents from the Obama White House, some in Chicago and some classified ones near Washington, D.C., and that none of them are in Obama's control.
Well, Trump supporters have also argued that he declassified a lot of material, which presidents do have the authority to do. So what are we learning about that?
Yeah, since this summer, one of Trump's allies named Kash Patel has argued Trump declassified this material in Florida. But the problem with that is that this process requires paperwork. It's not sure Trump has any paperwork to back up those claims. And legal experts who are studying these issues say that under the parts of the three laws the DOJ cited, it may not matter if the material has been declassified. You still can't take it home with you. And when the government asks for it, you need to give it back. And in fact, this has been going on back and forth all year. The archives alerted the Justice Department back in February, but it got 15 boxes of material Trump took to Florida with him. For some reason, he didn't turn over these other documents until the FBI came calling with a search warrant. So Merrick Garland, the attorney general, told reporters this week, the Justice Department actually uses the least intrusive methods it can, implying that Trump has been stonewalling all this time.
Wow. So the obvious question, Carrie, is what's next?
Yeah, there's a legal fight underway now to unseal the affidavit. That's the reasons why the FBI thought there was probable cause that a crime had been committed and that there was important evidence in Florida. Several media groups are trying to get that document made public in the coming weeks. And then there's this question of the ongoing federal investigation. What will a grand jury and the Justice Department do here? Will they decide to charge the former president or one of his aides with a crime? That is an enormous step to consider.
NPR's Carrie Johnson, thanks very much.
Happy to be here.
Democrats have left Washington for the last few weeks of their annual summer break on a high note.
The motion is adopted.
That's the sound of the House passing the roughly $700 billion Inflation Reduction Act after more than a year of negotiations.
The bill includes money to address climate change and increase domestic production of renewable energy, provisions to lower drug prices for millions, and an extension of some Affordable Care Act programs that were set to end. NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell has been following this bill throughout its entire journey. Good morning, Kelsey.
Hi, good morning.
So Democrats are celebrating the Inflation Reduction Act as a chance to address climate change, inflation, healthcare, corporate taxes. What exactly is in this bill?
Yeah, this is a really big list of things that they're trying to do here that covers a lot of ground. Now, I should say this is a bill that is down from their early goals of passing $3.5 trillion in spending. They have landed now on $700 billion. So this doesn't include things like child care and universal pre-K and paid family leave that Democrats originally wanted to pass here. But what it does do is it allows Medicare to negotiate directly on the cost of drugs, something that Democrats have wanted to do for a very long time. They also have a goal of reducing emissions by 40%, and they plan to do that with about $369 billion in climate and energy security investments. And that includes tax credits for wind, solar, and other renewable energy production, and credits to develop new technology. There are also incentives for residential and commercial investments in energy efficiency. And a lot of that is offset by tax changes, including a 15% minimum tax on billion-dollar corporations and more IRS enforcement. But this is a less ambitious package than they originally planned to do.
And so how quickly will most Americans be able to actually see these changes? Will any of it take effect soon enough to be a factor in November's midterm elections?
Well, when it comes to reducing inflation, so, you know, the title of the bill, don't expect anything immediately. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says the bill has negligible effects on inflation between 2022 and into 2023. So, you know, that's not going to hit right away. Many of the clean energy and energy efficiency tax credits will be available immediately, so that will be quick. But other things like the extended healthcare tax credits or the access to those expanded programs under the ACA, those just won't expire. So people aren't going to experience that as a new benefit. It's just making sure that they don't lose something that already exists. Though Medicare will start negotiating prescription drug prices at the start of 2023, those effects won't be noticed right away either. So a lot of that means that Democrats will have to figure out a way to explain the bill to people and make them feel it if they want it to be a factor in this upcoming election.
Okay. Now, this bill is substantially different from what President Biden promised when he announced his plan more than a year ago. How did Democrats reach this moment?
Well, we should say Democrats did pass this bill entirely on their own. No Republicans in the House or Senate voted for this bill. And a lot of it was just legislative work, the way bills come together. They negotiated and worked on policies, many of which took years. And, you know, senators were far more willing to kind of come together on these long-term big changes to policy when they had time to work it out together and through the committee process.
NPR's Kelsey Snell, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
And for more from Kelsey and our whole politics team, check out the NPR Politics Podcast. Fresh episodes Monday through Friday, wherever you listen.
Monday will mark 1 year since the Taliban swept into Kabul and took control of Afghanistan. For Afghans, there have been momentous changes since then. Many have left the country to seek better lives elsewhere.
For those who have stayed, life has grown harder and more uncertain. The country is suffering a hunger crisis and an economic meltdown, and secondary education is off limits to girls.
NPR's Dia Hadid is in the Afghan capital and joins us now. And a warning, her reporting includes sounds of gunfire. Good morning, Dia.
Good morning, Aisha.
Let's start in Kabul where you are. What is everyday life like for the people that you've been talking to?
Their lives are hard, but let's start with something unusual that happened today in Kabul. There was actually a rare protest held by women on a main street. And they too were marking what's nearly the first year of the anniversary of the Taliban's rule. by demanding their freedoms. Have a listen. Those women, they're chanting bread, work, freedom, political participation. And you see, the Taliban have harshly clamped down on dissent since they seized power. And in fact, the only people who protest their rule like this are these groups of women. And Taliban security forces dispersed the protest after a few minutes by firing in the air. And this is what that sounded like. And you will hear the sound of bullets here. This isn't the first time the Taliban have used guns to end protests, but this was unusual. This was heavy firing and multiple gunmen. Other people thought there might have been a celebratory wedding nearby. We didn't hear any reports of serious injuries and we quietly ducked out of the area. And just as straight away, life was continuing as normal. And that normal life is hard for many people. When you walk down the street, you can see labourers sleeping in their wheelbarrows by the side of the road. They're waiting for work. There's beggars everywhere, men, women and children. They're hungry.
What about the Taliban? Like, how are they governing?
Right. Well, the one big achievement of the Taliban after a year has largely held, and that is by winning this conflict and driving out American forces, they've ended decades of war in Afghanistan. That's no small thing. But they've mostly shied away from speaking to the media since a US strike on the Al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri in Kabul. And let's not forget that it was Al-Qaeda that carried out the 9/11 attacks, and that was the reason why the US invaded Afghanistan almost 20 years ago. And security is getting worse. There's been ISIS attacks in Kabul. The economy is in tatters. There's a hunger crisis. And all those problems are likely to continue.
I mean, and that's in part because other countries are refusing to recognize this Taliban government. Like, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And the international community is unlikely to recognize the Taliban government anytime soon. And that's because in the past few months, we've seen hardliners in the movement dominate decision making, and they're refusing to budge on basic international demands, like letting all girls go to secondary school. And this has an impact beyond the Taliban. Economic sanctions on Afghanistan are crushing ordinary Afghans. The UN has spent about $4 billion to keep Afghans from starving. And they say they'll need more money to prevent a famine this winter. But the question is, a Western country is going to keep giving to the UN and effectively underwrite a Taliban government that they see as increasingly intransigent?
So what about their supporters, the Taliban supporters? Like, how do they see this year?
I mean, they see the Taliban takeover as a David versus Goliath victory. It's a divine celebration for them. Like Shamsur Rahman, he used to be a fighter with the group. He spent years in American detention. We met him a few days ago, and he told us that his suffering was worth it because now they have Islamic law and Islamic government. But like a lot of Taliban loyalists, he doesn't actually agree with the ban on girls' education. Other Taliban supporters are unhappy with the security situation, and there's a concern that government mismanagement could squander what they see as their victory.
NPR's Dia Hadid reporting from Kabul, Afghanistan. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And that's Up First for Saturday, August 13th, 2022. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
And I'm Daniel Estrin. Up First is back tomorrow with the first episode in a new series from NPR's show Embedded. It's a look at Yonkers, New York, a city with a long and ugly history of bad policing. Are federal oversight and local promises enough to reform the police department?
Follow us on social media. We're at Up First on Twitter. And for more news and interviews, books and music, you can find us on the radio. You know, that thing with the little knobs. Listen to us there.
Yeah, it's called Weekend Edition. Saturday and Sunday mornings. Find your NPR station at stations.npr.org.